Hi, and welcome to the 20 Lessons podcast. In this installment, we're going to talk about Judaism's way of responding to death and to mourning. It's quite a thoughtful and helpful way of interacting with death, really brilliant in its scope. And what I wanted to do is really go through the major details and going through that first year of mourning, then a little bit afterwards as well. So I just want to begin by talking about superstitions. I think that some people think that there's a superstition, you know, that people feel that it's superstitious to talk about death, to talk about what's going to happen when we die, to talk about purchasing a plot and all of those types of things. I just want to share that, you know, that in Judaism, buying a plot, making a will, those are actually, for those that are superstitious, they are actually considered segulot, which means omens or things that we can do to bring upon a blessing for long life, as well creating a medical proxy. All of those are extremely important things to take care of, and if we have families, are one of the most helpful things we can do for our families, because you know, you see all the time families that have to take care of these things in those couple of hours after a loved one dies, and it's a very difficult situation to be in. So I just wanted to point that out. So a person passes away. So really, from the moment of death until burial, preferably the deceased should not be left alone. That's why in Judaism we have what's called a shomer, or a watcher, which is somebody that you can arrange who will stay by the loved one, the deceased loved person's loved one's side at all times. And basically what that watcher does traditionally, the shomer, is they watch the body. They're there in order the body not be left alone, and they recite Tehillim, they recite from the Book of Psalms. After passing away, based on the verse in Ecclesiastes that says, as he came, so shall he go. We think about a newborn child being immediately washed as they enter this world. They're clean and they're pure. So we try to make sure that the person that departs this world is the same. So we cleanse and we make pure the corpse, the dead person, through a religious ritual called Tahara, which means purification. It's performed by the Chevra Kadisha, which is literally translated as the Holy Society, the Jewish Burial Society, which in Ottawa, we are so incredibly blessed that we have a robust Chevra Kadisha, all made up of volunteers. Volunteer hours that go into it is unbelievable. And if anyone listening lives in Ottawa, definitely please think about joining. And in addition to physically cleansing the body and preparing the body for burial, the Chevra Kadisha also recites the required prayers, asking God for forgiveness for sins, praying that God guard and watch over this person and grant them eternal peace. That's basically what the Tahara is. There's many different details, but as an overview, that's what it is. Then we get to preparing the body for burial, which is a Jewish person. Jewish tradition recognizes the democracy of death, and it demands that all Jews be buried in the same type of garment. So no matter who you are, all are equal before God. And therefore everyone wears the same thing. In fact, 1900 years ago, the Talmudic sage Rabbi Gamliel instituted this practice that everybody wear the same thing so that no one would be shamed, and the wealthy wouldn't vie with each other in displaying the costliness of the burial clothes, as we see happens when it comes to caskets nowadays. The clothes that should be worn are clothes that are simple, appropriate for one who's to stand before God. They are handmade, perfectly clean, white. They have no pockets because you can't carry anything with you. And they're called tachrichim in Hebrew, which means shrouds. On that idea of not carrying anything with you, I just want to share a quick story. So one of the Reichman brothers, and it may be a story that actually happened, or it may be legend, but it's told of one of the Reichman brothers, so a very wealthy philanthropist in Toronto. And, you know, he leaves over for his family like $1 billion. And he leaves two wills. The first one he asked to be opened immediately upon death, and the second one should be opened at the Shloshim after 30 days, since he passes, after 30 days, after that 30-day period of mourning. In the first will was a request that he be buried with a certain pair of socks that he owned. So the Reichman children, they immediately brought the socks to the Chevra Kadisha, to the burial society, requesting that their father be buried in them. The Chevra Kadisha, of course, refused, reminding the family that it's against halacha, it's against Jewish law to bury anyone in socks. And they pleaded, and they explained that their father was a very pious, a very learned man, and he had very good reason to make this request. He wouldn't have requested this if he thought that it was against the Jewish law. But the Chevra Kadisha remained firm in their refusal. And the family frantically summoned the Chevra Kadisha, in fact, to the Beis Din, to the Jewish court, demanding that they bury their father with socks, with these socks. The head of the Jewish court gently explained to them that although your father left that request when he was in this world, now that he's in the world of truth, he surely understands that it's in his best interest not to be buried with socks. So he's buried without his socks. 30 days later, the second will was open, and it read something like this: "My dear children, by now you must have buried me without my socks. I wanted you to truly understand that a man can have $1 billion, but in the end, he can't even take along one pair of socks." So we really try to reflect that in preparation for burial. The Torah requires burial to happen as soon as possible following death, preferably within 24 hours. However, it can be delayed as long as it's for the honor of the person that passed away. So for a child to get there, or for a great number of people for the funeral to get there, that's when it's an honor to push off the burial, and so we can do. Now, from the moment of death, each immediate relative, so those are the mourners, and we'll talk about who are the actual mourners, but each immediate relative of the deceased is considered an onane. And you're in this category of an onane from the moment you hear about the death until the burial. Now, what exactly is an onane? It describes a person in deep distress, right? You're yanked out of normal life, and you're now in the midst of this inexpressible grief, very disoriented, emotions out of gear. And that's how the sages viewed this person. And it's very unfortunate, but it's in this state of mind that the mourner has to make these detailed and final arrangements with the funeral director, with the Chevra Kadisha, with the cemetery, with the rabbi, notifying friends and family. And that is so difficult to do as you grapple with your own loss. So what we do here is what the sages enacted is that in order to give the onane one less thing to worry about, they basically exempted this onane from a whole bunch of ritual practices. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. Let's just first talk about who it is that is obligated to mourn, and then we'll talk about the onane a little bit more. So when we talk about who becomes an official mourner, you have a father, a mother, a brother, a sister, a son, a daughter, or a spouse. So there's seven. So those are the people that become onanes. Those are the people that become official mourners that go through Shiva, that tear their clothes, and so on and so forth. And we'll talk more about this. So as I was explaining, the onane is in a very, very difficult place. So they are required to abide by the following rules. So number one, they don't eat meat or drink wine or liquor. They don't eat any festive meals. They don't self-adorn, bathe for pleasure, shave, take a haircut. So they indulge in marital relations. They don't do normal business during this time. You're not allowed to study the Torah because that's a source of enjoyment. So basically, all of the observances during Shiva that a mourner has during Shiva fall upon the onane, except you can wear shoes and you can leave the house. And we're going to talk more about the burial, the practices of it during Shiva. But as I was saying, because you are so busy and in such a terrible emotional state, so everything's out of whack, the onane is released from the obligations of prayer and other specific positive ritual observances. So you don't have to make blessings before or after you eat. You can't be included in a minyan. You can't be included in a quorum. And really, all that you are still obligated in is to obey the negative commandments. And in fact, not only are you not obligated in the positive commandments, but you are actually you should not be performing them either. The last one that we don't do is the tefillin. We don't lay the tefillin. That's because tefillin is considered an object of beautification, and it's inconsistent with the inner bitterness experienced by the mourner so soon after the loss of their loved one. Okay, so we've now got into the burial. Prior to the burial, you have one of the most striking Jewish expressions of grief, which is the tearing of the garments prior to the funeral service. The Torah records many instances of tearing of the garments after hearing about death. When Yaakov, the patriarch Jacob, saw Joseph's coat of many colors, and he thought that it was drenched in what was his son's blood, he tore his garments. King David tore his garments when he heard of the death of his predecessor, King Saul. And Job, who knew grief so well and from whom we learn so many different mourning practices, Job, he stood up and also tore his garments. Interestingly, the rending, the tearing of garments is really an opportunity in a way for psychological relief. It allows you to give vent to your pent-up anguish through a controlled, religiously sanctioned act of destruction. That's the idea here. Maimonides, in fact, explains that the tear satisfies the emotional need of the moment, or else it wouldn't be permitted because it's a clear violation of the biblical command not to cause waste because you're wasting your garment. Nowadays, the tearing is usually done at the funeral chapel, before the funeral ceremony or before the service begins. Usually the rabbi is present, can supervise the tearing in accordance with the traditional laws. Usually that's when the entire family is gathered together and they can do this together, standing united through this very charged expression of bereavement. And after they all tear, then there's a blessing that's said, that goes very simply, Baruch Dayan HaEmet, blessing God for judging in truth. Okay, and then the funeral service begins. Generally, it starts with some form of a prayer. For a male, it's generally a psalm. For a female, it's the Woman of Valor poem by King Solomon from the Book of Proverbs and Mishlei. Then you have eulogies, generally given by family members, perhaps friends, a rabbi. And then you do the memorial prayer, which is called the Mole, Kel Mole Rachamim, beseeching God who is full of mercy. And then, after that, the burial part happens. In Judaism, we traditionally have pallbearers. They're from among the family or friends. They carry the casket and help put it into the grave. This actually goes back to the Torah, when Jacob's children carried him to his last resting place. And it's considered a signal of honor and a symbol of personal tribute for those who participate. After placing the body in the grave, the grave is filled at this time. At the very minimum, the casket should be filled, but we try as much as we can to fill it up entirely by hand. It's a signal, again, of honor and duty to help shovel the earth to cover the casket. And at many funerals, we ask everybody present to help take part in this last, basically one of the, you know, this sign of honor to the person that has passed away. There are interesting customs that we are careful of, that we observe when doing the shoveling. We don't pass the shovel from hand to hand, but rather each person places the shovel back onto the earth that they're shoveling. The idea there is, it's, you know, it has a certain sense of superstition to it, but it's a symbolic gesture expressing the prayer that the tragedy of this moment not be quote-unquote contagious, and that everybody present will live long and peaceful lives. Some will use the back of the shovel to indicate a difference from its use for other purposes. So interesting little customs that have been incorporated into the shoveling of the grave. Once the grave is covered, then the mourners recite a particular Kaddish. Kaddish is a specific prayer that's recited by mourners. If your one's parents pass away, then you say it for the entire first 11 months after your parent passes away. If you're saying it for your brother or sister or child, or for any of those, God forbid, then you say it. For the first 30 days after the burial. Now, there's a special Kaddish that is said after the burial, right? Meaning for the rest of the time, you say the normal Kaddish. The post-burial Kaddish is actually a little different. It takes the form of a prayer instead of a statement. The burial Kaddish is basically a prayer that affirms that God will create the world anew. The deceased will be raised up in everlasting life, right? And the Messiah will come. The temple will be rebuilt. The true worship of one God will replace the idols of the masses. There's basically, it's a Kaddish that prays and has hope for a future for the deceased. And it gives new faith to the mourners as well, even though it's happening right after the burial. Once the Kaddish is finished, then we have what's called a recessional. And basically everybody present forms two lines that the mourners walk through. And as the mourners walk through, everybody present recites the traditional words of comfort that is said to somebody that is mourning that go like this. Hamakom yenachem etchem betoch she'ar avelei Tzion v'Yerushalayim, which means may God comfort you among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. And those words are said at that moment in time and also at the end of a Shiva visit, which then brings us to the Shiva. So now the mourners have gone home and the Shiva begins. During Shiva, one is expected to stay inside of their home as much as possible. There are extenuating circumstances for which you can go out, but in general, you stay inside. You continue wearing your torn garment. You sit on the low stool. You wear slippers. You don't wear leather shoes. You refrain from shaving and grooming. That time begins the reciting of the Kaddish, and one's acquaintances come to the home to express sympathy in their distress. So that's the Shiva period. So you had your Aninut, you had your Onain period, which was prior between the finding out about the death and the burial. Then after the burial, you get into Shiva, which is a 7-day period, and then the next 23 days is called the Shloshim. In other words, for the 30 days after burial, which includes the Shiva, you have what's called Shloshim. During that time, you still are in an intense form of mourning, but you're not in the form of mourning. It's lessened from Shiva. At this point, you are encouraged to leave the house, slowly rejoin society, but still understanding that not enough time has elapsed to assume your normal social relations. Sometimes their rent garments, your torn garments, may customarily still be worn for parents. During those 30 days, haircutting for male mourners is still prohibited, as is the shaving. And then after the 30 days are up, then you have what is called the 12-month mourning period. So as I said, Kaddish for parents is said for 11 months, but for parents, the mourning period goes for a full 12 months from the burial. During this time, a lot begins to go back to normal. So after the Shloshim, after the first 30 days, things begin to go back to normal. You go back to business, it's completely routine, but you still have this wound. You still have this feeling of, the rupture of this relationship with a parent. So the pursuit of entertainment and amusement is curtailed during this time. But once 12 months is up, then the mourner is expected to stop his mourning, except for brief moments of time during the year, which we'll talk about. And in fact, Judaism rebukes a person who mourns more than his prescribed period. We have a very specific system of mourning, and it's supposed to allow you to express and to feel the emotions that you're supposed to, that you need to feel in order to recover, in order to healthfully get through it. But there's also something that's considered excessive mourning, and that you are rebuked for. Now, just to mention, after those 12 months are up, then throughout the year, you do have your brief moments where you reflect and you contemplate, and perhaps you even mourn. And those are during, number one, Yizkor, on Yom Kippur, on the last day of Sukkot, Shmini Atzeret, on the last day of Pesach, on the second day of Shavuot. So four times a year, we have what's called Yizkor, which is when the community comes together and collectively reflects. Yizkor means to remember, remembers the loved ones that they had lost. And the moment you have lost a loved one, you stay inside for Yizkor in the synagogue. And if you have not lost a loved one, then you actually leave. You're not part of Yizkor in the synagogue. As well, of course, every year you have the Yortzeit. The Yortzeit is the anniversary of the passing of a loved one, and that also becomes a time of reflection and remembering. Now, so those are the different stages of mourning. Let's talk for a minute about the Shiva. So I mentioned some of the things that we refrain from in the Shiva. Let's go through it a little bit more. So number one, we cover the mirrors in the Shiva. This custom is of uncertain origin, but of course it is very appropriate. One of the reasons may just be is that has to do with vanity, right? At this time, we should be thinking about anything but, the way we look, and we kind of symbolize that through covering the mirrors. During Shiva, we also don't sit on chairs of normal height. And this basically is the idea that we're sensing the loneliness and depression you feel after one's relative was buried in the very earth on which you sat, right? So you're going to sit lower. It's a physical adjustment to one's emotional state, a lowering of the body to the level of one's feelings. There's a lot to it. And of course, this is just an overview, but we could talk about the psychological power of so much of this for a very long time. As I explained, during Shiva, there's a prohibition against work and doing business. We don't wear leather shoes at this time, very similar to Yom Kippur. It's symbolic of the personal, disregard of vanity and comfort to better concentrate on the deeper meaning of what's going on. And it stems from the prophet Ezekiel being told to remove his shoes when he is in mourning. As well, there's an avoidance of pleasure during mourning, so that is why it's prohibited to engage in marital relations during Shiva. That's why we don't study Torah during Shiva, unless we study specifically the parts of Torah that are actually not joyous, and there are different parts that are like that. And then when Shiva is over, the mourners go outside for a short walk together, which symbolizes the return to society from which the mourner had withdrawn. Just another couple of things that we don't do during Shiva: we don't bathe or shower for pleasure. And now, of course, Jewish tradition has always emphasized how important washing and hygiene is. But the sages of the Talmud realized that washing was also practiced for comfort, and that form of washing was not consistent with the spirit of mourning. So too with hair cutting and cosmetics. So if one is mourning relatives other than one's parents, then haircuts are not permitted until the end of the 30-day period. And there are a whole bunch of other things as well. Now, I just want to mention that if you are mourning for one's parents, then theoretically, you shouldn't cut your hair for 12 months. However, the law provides for the principle of social reproach, and that's in quote unquote. That is in quotes. This means that those in mourning for parents can cut their hair after the 30 days, at the first instance of even mild reproach or criticism by friends or neighbors that you look disheveled. And immediately when that happens, you can take a haircut, as long as it's after 30 days. Now, what we practice today is that this reproach does not have to be articulated. If the length of the hair is so marked that one can be characterized as someone that looks disheveled, then you can take a haircut. And as I explain, the 30-day period, the shloshim, constitutes the full mourning for all relatives other than the father and the mother. Whereas for the father and mother, it goes for a full 12 months. Just for an idea of for a father and mother, which observances stand during the 12 months. So as I explained, I just explained about haircutting. Wearing of new clothes is only permitted upon social reproach as well after the 30 days. And also after being worn for a brief period of time by others. Because technically not wearing new clothes is a 12-month observance for parents. A mourner should change his usual seat in the synagogue at prayer. Although on Shabbat, you can sit in your usual place. Again, like just to show that things are out of sorts. Things are different right now. And the physical reality should reflect our internal, our emotional reality. And what we're also told is that during this time, a mourner in general should pay closer attention to educational, charitable, and religious matters, because these are the most beautiful tributes to the lessons that we learned from our parents that passed away. So you'll find that it's customary for a mourner to study a portion of the Torah before or after services. And it's also appropriate that they learn to lead all or part of the congregational services and then go ahead and lead it for the congregation. It's really quite special when you see the number of people who generally don't come to synagogue who take this upon themselves. And they come to synagogue every day to say Kaddish. And then once they're at synagogue, they begin to learn so much that they had never really experienced before because they never came to synagogue on a regular basis. They learn all about what a weekday service looks like, all of the different markings of the Jewish year, the minor festivals that are not as well known, what it means to put on tefillin and a talis, and many also learn how to lead the services. And for some, it means learning how to read Hebrew and then leading how. Some already know how to read Hebrew, but it's just an extremely, there's some sort of very special testament to the Jewish people, I find, that even if this was never part of their life, when they lose a parent, they do this for a year. And then, of course, it's even more special when you continue afterwards, even if not to the same extent, but to some extent, it's really quite incredible. As well, there's also a whole thing, as well, for a parent, there are also very specific rules around participating in joyous celebrations for the 12 months. Those details can be complex, but certainly if they come up, ask your local rabbi to help you out with that one. Okay, so we've gone through basically the mourning periods and how exactly they work and what they're about. Now what we should talk about for a moment is the setting up of a tombstone. So back in Genesis, the Torah describes that Rachel, the matriarch, so the wife of Jacob, the third generation of matriarchs, so the Torah says she died and was buried on the way to Ephrat, which is Bethlehem. And Jacob erected a tombstone on Rachel's grave. So erecting a monument or a tombstone is a very ancient tradition. And whether the stone is placed directly over the grave or as a footstone or as a headstone, the monument is extremely important and serves three basic purposes. The number one, it serves three basic purposes for us to know where this is as far as ritual impurity is concerned, and others as well. And as well, just a sign of honor that this person is recognized enough that someone took the time and effort to put this stone up for them. It's a sign of love. It's a sign of respect. Let's talk for a moment about excessive grave visitation. Judaism traditionally did not encourage a lot of grave visitation. Right? The sages were apprehensive that if you visit the cemetery too often, it might become a pattern of living, and it would prevent the mourner from placing those that passed away, their dead, in proper perspective. They didn't want the grave to become some sort of ultra significant prayer spot at which the mourner would pray to the dead rather than to God, which would of course violate one of the cardinal principles of Judaism, that God is one and there is no other gods. But basically, the idea is that we just want to make sure that people respond to this in a healthy manner. And it is a possibility, a very strong possibility, that you won't let go whatsoever, and it will constantly plague you and serve as an obstacle to living your life fully if you stay too connected to the dead. So it's a balance, because of course the lessons and the inspiration of the one that passes away always needs to stay with us. But on the other hand, it cannot keep us back. We cannot be caught in this grief that doesn't allow us to ever take the next step in our lives. So the sages of the Talmud really tried to balance those two ideas when it came to suggesting what appropriate grave visitation looks like. And in fact, various customs have arisen regarding the proper times for visiting the graves of loved ones, right? And they basically say that propitious times to visit the grave are on days of calamity or of decisive moments in life, the concluding day of Shiva and Shloshim, on the Yahrzeit, fast days such as Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, before the high holidays, and other days as well. These would be proper times for families to visit their beloved deceased. So again, there's no rule of thumb as to the annual frequency of visitation, just avoiding the extremes of constant visitation on the one hand and complete disregard on the other. I think that's as far as we'll go on that. Now, as far as tombstones are concerned, there is a service, it's called the Hakamat Matseva, which means the setting up of a tombstone, that is a formal religious dedication of the monument. You try to hold that unveiling, in English we refer to it as an unveiling, and in fact, some communities do an actual unveiling where they put a sheet over the tombstone and then take it off. That's not what we do, but there is that. And the customary to hold this unveiling within the first year after death. So basically any time between the end of Shiva and the Yahrzeit. I already spoke about Yizkor, the memorial service, the communal memorial service that we do. And then, as I said, we have the Yahrzeit. And we'll stop with this. The Yahrzeit, now what does Yahrzeit mean? Yahrzeit means Yahrzeit, which is a year's time. So in other words, the anniversary of the passing. In other languages, some refer to it as a hilula, which also is a yahrzeit, an anniversary of passing. And it becomes a very special day with special observances to commemorate the anniversary of the death of loved ones. The Talmud discusses it, so it has very early origins. And basically, the way the Talmud describes it is it's a description of this instinctive sentiment of sadness, almost like a annual rehearsing of tragedy, which therefore kind of compels one to avoid eating meat and drinking wine, which are symbols of festivity and joy. And as well, on this time, we try to engage in specific religious observances, learning Torah, giving extra charity, all in order to help us perpetuate the legacy of the loved one that we lost. So Yahrzeit is a very special time, a very, very special, moving, sometimes very sad time. So that's a little bit about Judaism's take on death and mourning. Again, we tried to start from the beginning and go to all the way through to the Yahrzeit. And in fact, the four times a year memorialization that happens at Yizkor. Of course, everything that I spoke about has more to detail. Each one could have a chapter written on it on its own. But those are the basics I would share when it comes to Judaism on death and mourning. If you ever have any questions on this, please don't hesitate to be in touch. And we'll stop here for today.